Thanks, Tony. Okay, so this is an interesting experiment. This is a talk I usually give to an audience of quantum field theory people and maybe mathematical physicists and mathematicians. So in this audience of atomic physicists and laser physicists, I'm going to restrict my attention purely to quantum mechanics. I'll tell you something that I think is quite surprising about quantum mechanics, but I want to say at the very beginning that that's not the reason I'm doing this. The reason I'm doing this and the reason I'm interested in it is applications in quantum field theory. And let me just say in advance, there are some fundamental problems in quantum field theories that are truly strongly interacting, where the question of whether you use perturbation theory or non-perturbative physics is a lot more urgent than even in the strong field atomic physics regime. But to put that in further context, even in quantum mechanics or in atomic physics, and this is well known in many branches of physics, actually in chemistry, one of the really big problems we have is that we don't understand very well how to analytically continue path integrals. This is a big problem. We can do many computations in what's called Euclidean time. We analytically continue to complex time. We can now do Monte Carlo type calculations for systems that we can't do in Minkowski space. But the question of analytically continuing back again is extremely deep, and we actually know very little about this problem. And so the subtext of everything I'm going to talk about is that question. What can we possibly learn about analytic continuation of path integrals? And I hope by the end that I'll convince you that this, at least this idea of resurgence, opens a new window to that question. We don't have the answer yet, or I'd be giving you a talk about non-equilibrium physics or solving the sine problem or something like that, but that's the motivation. So this is mainly work, what I'm going to talk about is mainly work with a series of papers over the last 2 years with Mithat Unsal, also with Gökçe Bazar, Alexey Cherman, Daniela Daragonis at Cambridge, and Philippa Giras, who's in Cincinnati. So these are applications both to quantum field theory and also to quantum mechanics. The papers on quantum mechanics are the three that I've listed there. And if by some chance you're interested in learning more about this, I gave a series of lectures at the Winter School at CERN this February. They're online, you can just Google it. And this was explicitly aimed at students, so probably readable, hopefully readable. Okay, so this is a funny word. Somebody already mentioned that it sounds religious. Many people have made this comment. If I weren't being recorded, I'd make some comments about that, but maybe later. So the idea, what's the basic idea? Is a systematic... unification of perturbation theory and non-perturbative physics. Okay, so I have to now tell you what that means. You all know what perturbation theory is. You have some idea of what non-perturbative physics is, means different things to different people in different fields. But this is what I'm going to explain. The word comes from the mathematics literature. The French mathematician Jean Eccles in Orsay, who came up with this in about 1980. It's a general framework in mathematics. I'll say a little bit more about that later. But the basic idea, it's a new way of thinking about problems where there's some small parameter. If you look at a typical quantum mechanics book or a quantum field theory book, there's a chapter on perturbation theory, and maybe later on there's a chapter on semi-classical methods or non-perturbative physics. And if you're really unlucky, it's in volume 2 and the other one's in volume 1. But the idea is to try and treat them together, and there's some advantage to doing that. All right. So, the basic problem we have to deal with, let me give you a picture to stare at if you get bored. let me draw some points. So these are supposed to be critical points of some sort. So if I'm talking about a differential equation, these are the turning points in WKB language. They may be on the real axis, they may be on the in the complex plane if you're doing over the variance scattering, but there are some critical points. And there are fluctuations around these critical points. Let me sketch it like this. If I were talking about an integral and eventually a path integral, these points are saddle points. Okay? And so we can think about an expansion in saddle points or critical points, and then we can think about fluctuations around those critical points or saddle points. Okay? Now the point of resurgence is that this non-perturbative expansion over the critical points or saddle points is deeply related to the fluctuations around each saddle point. So for example, the really extreme statement of resurgence is that if you know everything about the fluctuations around this point, you can reconstruct everything about all the other points. Okay? So that's the extreme statement. The question is, that's a mathematical statement, there are certain functions that satisfy this. The physics question is, are there any physical systems that behave like this? And by the end of the talk, I will have convinced you, I hope, that there are. So, facts of life about perturbation theory. There's a perturbation theory is divergent. So it sounds bad when you first hear it, but it's actually a very good thing. And it's typically asymptotic theories. So to be really concrete in this talk, I want to restrict myself to quantum mechanics, just one-dimensional non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And imagine you're calculating some energy and you generate a perturbative series in powers of some small parameter g squared. I'm calling it g squared from it's deeply ingrained in people who do quantum field theory, but just thinking of it as the small parameter g squared. Okay, and there are some coefficients. And with enough work, you can generate information about those coefficients just from perturbation theory. Now, typically, these diverge and they diverge factorially. Okay? So, for example, the Zeeman effect. You put an atom in a magnetic field, you calculate the corrections to the energy level, so the ground state. Everyone's done the first order, everyone's probably done the second order, maybe nobody's done higher orders. The coefficients, an, grow like 2n factorial, and alternate in sign. Just a fact. Okay? You can now do the Stark effect. Place an atom in an electric field, static electric field. Again, absolutely straightforward calculation. Systematic, you learn that An grows like 2n. There's some prefactor here, but not important. Grow like 2n factorial. Okay? Any other interesting quantum mechanics problem you can give me, they grow factorially in magnitude. But there's a big distinction between whether they alternate in sign or not. And some mathematical jargon is that this is what's we refer to this as Borel summable, and this as non-Borel summable. Now, what's the idea of Borel summation? It's a way of extracting both mathematical and physical information from a divergent series. A divergent series doesn't mean that you did something wrong. It just means that you have to know something more than convergent series to extract information. So the Borel summation is a vast field, but let me give you the idea. Suppose you tried to sum this series. Okay. It's actually the expansion of one of these exponential integral functions, so you can actually just look it up. The idea is you rewrite n factorial this. Everyone learns that formula in high school. And then you bravely interchange summation and integration. And now the sum over n is trivial. It's just a geometric series. And the point is that that integral is perfectly convergent for any positive g squared. So you define the Borel sum of that divergent series to be this integral. And another way of looking at it is that if you actually did this calculation without using perturbation theory, you may actually end up with this integral. And then if somebody asks you to expand that integral for a small g squared, this is what you would get. Okay? Now, again, there's a lot of literature about under what circumstances this is allowed or not. The unfortunate thing is that in really interesting physics examples, we rarely have enough information about what we're trying to calculate to know whether it satisfies all the fine print. But just trust me that there are results here, honest results. Okay, now that's if it's alternating in sign. Suppose it's not alternating in sign. Okay. Formally, I just changed the sign of g squared. Right? So formally, I do that. And now you see that there's a new problem. Because on the contour of integration, there's now a pole. Okay? So you have to tell me what to do with the pole. Okay? And the question is, from perturbation theory, how do you know what to do with the pole? And whatever happens, you're going to generate an imaginary part which goes like that. Right? The pole is at s equals 1 over g squared, so you'll generate from the pole an imaginary part which goes like e to the minus 1 over g squared. You don't know in advance necessarily whether it's plus I or minus I, and you have to provide some physical input to decide. The interesting thing about this is that you started in perturbation theory with a series where every single term was real, and you ended up with an imaginary part.
Yeah, but which is you start getting things clear, right? Because it's
Cady, that's my next sentence. Do you want to get okay. All right. So, next sentence. So there's a mathematical way around this, is that you've got some pole in this Borel plane, and so instead of just integrating through this, you can deform your contour to go above or below, and then the difference between these two is some ambiguity, and the physics goal is to understand, first of all, why there's a pole and what you should do with it. So now Arkady can give the next sentence, is that if we go back here, this fits very nicely with our physics intuition. You apply a magnetic field to an atom, you shift the levels. Okay, and you shift the levels by, with a plus there, that much. And everything's real, no problem. You apply an electric field to an atom, you also shift the levels. And that's the real part of this integral, and that's the Stark shift. But you also ionize, okay? And so the imaginary part gives you the rate. From that, you can extract the rate of ionization. In fact, this is a physical proof that perturbation theory must be divergent. Because there's essentially no difference between an electric field and a magnetic field, except by Lorentz invariance flipping the sign of E squared or B squared. If you were to do perturbation theory and discover that it were convergent with a magnetic field and then convert to an electric field, there would be no imaginary part, okay? So you just proved that perturbation theory is divergent. There's an exact analog of this. There's an exact analog of this in the Euler-Heisenberg context. This is about this strong field pair production. If you apply either a magnetic field or an electric field to the QED vacuum, you actually get a series where it's not just that you know the asymptotic behavior, you know the coefficients. They're basically Bernoulli numbers, and you can check explicitly that the pair creation rate comes exactly through this mechanism. So, yes, question.
Yes, my recollection was that the series for the Stark effect was at 10-8.
No.
That's because it was non-Borel, but Padé's Lorentz event?
It's non-alternating. It must be non-alternating, otherwise.
Okay.
So, yeah. No, this is all very well studied. So, okay, so this fits with our intuition, so we think we could stop there. The surprise is, if you now, for this audience, suppose you do H2+. Okay. So this is a double well problem. Got two nuclei, got one electron. If the nuclei are very far apart, then the electron sits in one well and it's just normal single atom stuff. You bring them closer together, something interesting happens, there's tunneling effects, etc. So imagine you were to do perturbation theory in the inverse separation distance, just like that. Okay? You discover, obviously, that it's divergent. So you would write here E as a series of An over, let's say, the separation between the two nuclei. And to your surprise, you discover that this is actually non-alternating. Okay? So now Arcadi's argument doesn't work. There's absolutely nothing unstable or decaying about this problem. So what's going on?
No, you still can take R imaginary.
R is the separation.
No, you can stable for the first time.
It's tunnel. So
you can take R imaginary, then you will see similarity.
You can. So if you're a little bit more sophisticated, you discover, of course, that because of tunneling, there's splitting. And the splitting goes like, in some units, e to the minus r. Again, obvious. And this is what we call a single instanton effect. The difficulty is this 2 here. The 2 here tells you that, in fact, the pole corresponding to this divergence gives you an exponential factor that's e to the minus 2r. So in fact, this splitting is not immediately directly related to this divergence. Okay? And that's the issue. Moreover, because it's non-alternating, this is non-Borel summable, the contribution would have an I in front of it, whereas this is a real splitting. There's no I anyway. Okay? So that's the beginning of the story in the quantum mechanics context. All right, so a great insight came in about 1980. Separately in about 1980, Bogomolny and Zinjestan, also Brazin and Parisi and company were involved in this, had this great insight that, in fact, in doing these problems, you don't just have this single instanton effect. There's tunneling back and forth many times. And if you look at the next order in the exponentials, you have contributions from two instantons to anti-instantons, but also from what's called an instanton-anti-instanton. And this guy is unstable. And if you calculate the contribution from that one, you discover also, you discover there's an imaginary part, which goes like e to the minus 2r in this context. And it exactly cancels the pole contribution you got from perturbation theory.
Okay. So could you just translate into molecular physics? What is an instanton in this H2?
It's the tunneling effect, right? So this level is split. Okay. So to leading order, you just generate this. That's fine. And so if you're not concerned about the fact that this guy is divergent and non-Borel summable, you just stop there and, you know, that's what you'll measure. But if you're concerned about whether perturbation theory is well-defined or not and how it relates to non-perturbative physics, you should be worried about the fact that this generates an imaginary part. But these guys tell you that if, in fact, you take more seriously to the next order this splitting effect, you generate exactly the same term and it cancels from them. Okay, a beautiful calculation. I strongly recommend these as quantum mechanics exercises. And this is the first hint of resurgence. Okay? It's a combination of a non-perturbative calculation with a perturbative calculation, which resolves a problem in either perturbation theory or non-perturbative physics. Remember that in this problem, if you just did perturbation theory, you would be led to a contradiction of having an imaginary energy. And if you just did non-perturbative physics at the two instanton level, you would also be led to a contradiction. You would calculate an imaginary part to the energy. The idea of resurgence is that you shouldn't do these two things separately. You should do them together. And when you combine them, these ambiguities cancel and you have something that's real and unambiguous. Okay? So that's the basic idea.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Why do we just add these two terms? Is that not
that's not
every, the other?
So from the computation, it's obvious. It shouldn't be obvious just yet. But in this picture, it's clear. Okay. You're adding the contribution from two subtle points, basically. All right, so now let me tell you a little bit about where this name came from the math literature. So again, this is Jean et Carl. This is a very abstract idea, but it's found a lot of applications in differential equations, nonlinear differential equations, both partial and ordinary differential equations. It seems to be a very powerful idea, but it's also a little bit hard to pin down and define. So the idea is you shouldn't try to write down the perturbative series for this energy. This is incomplete. What you should actually write down is something called a trans series, which is a triple sum with some coefficients . So there's perturbation theory, powers of, then there's non-perturbative terms, powers of the basic e to the minus 1 over g squared, and the thing that's surprising, less obvious, is sums over logarithms of g squared. Okay, so that's what a trans series is. And the idea is to replace a Taylor series or asymptotic series by a trans series. Now, why on earth would you want to do that? As physicists, we recognize all of these terms. This is perturbation theory. These are non-perturbative instanton type effects, tunneling type effects. And these, if you've ever tried to do a two instanton order calculation, this is exactly this instability due to the attraction between instantons and anti-instantons.
You can put one more h squared if you put it in z.
I could do that, yes. Now, what was it?
Analog of Lanyon, because in Lanyon you do have log.
Yep. So now what was Eckhart doing? Just to put this in context, he was asking, so he's a very pure mathematician, he was asking the following question. What set of functions is closed under one Borel summation to analytic continuation? Three Laplace transforms. And basically, Laplace transforms and Borel summation are inverses of one another. So this is a very abstract question. And the answer is that you need combinations of g squared, e to the minus 1 over g squared, and log of g squared. So this is apparently a very, you build all functions from iterations of these three objects. Note that these three objects don't mix. This is an example thereof. Okay.
What is another example?
So you can, so in the more formal definition, you can iterate. You can have log of log of log of log, exponential of exponential of exponential. But these are the three basic objects. And these.
Without expand, say, just where log.
Of course, it's a special case.
It's possible.
Yeah.
I mean,
three basic objects in one sense, so yeah. In the sense that you don't need anything else. Okay.
But you're allowed to have
let's step back for a second. Right. So mathematicians view this in the following way. Here's an interesting set of objects. What type of functions are closed on this? And the answer is, with some small fine print, functions built out of iterations of these. As physicists, the interesting question is this relevant to anything we want to do? And if it's relevant, is it actually useful? Or is it just another way
of... Does that mean I also have inverse powers of part of this? I think log, give it log of this for you, log of this for
you. Probably.
You see, if you put say that it is one or g squared in the power which is not integer but close to integer, then you are getting log right away.
Yes.
So you see that it's like anomalous dimension or something like that of g squared.
Yes. I don't want to get too caught up in this, okay? Imagine you create a set of functions that are built out of these objects and iterations thereof.
By iterations, you mean?
I mean exponential of exponential of exponential and log of log of log of log of log. Okay? The statement is that under some conditions on the Borel transforms, and that's what it defines a resurgent function, these guys are closed under those operations. Fine. The point, as physicists, is that this turns out to be useful, this concept. So let me show you how you would decode a trans series. So first of all, just a comment, if you write down an asymptotic series that's divergent, say you expand something along the real line, that series on its own doesn't contain information about how to analytically continue the function. The classic example is the gamma function, the log of the gamma function to make a summation. The leading term is just the Stirling approximation. We know that's spectacularly good along the real axis. If you write the rest of the series, it turns out to be divergent, factorially divergent, asymptotic. And that series is completely consistent with the basic fact about the gamma function, which is that x gamma of x is gamma of 1 plus x. Okay, it's the defining relation of the gamma function. But that series is not consistent with the other interesting thing you know about the gamma function, which is the reflection formula, that gamma of x is related to gamma of 1 minus x. And that comes from the analytic continuation of the gamma function. And that asymptotic series you wrote down is inconsistent with that relation. Okay? But the good news is a trans series representation of the gamma function of this form is consistent with the analytic continuation. So another way to look at resurgence is that if you build asymptotic expansions of some function, you can do it in such a way that it's consistent with the analytic continuation properties, but the price you pay is that it's not enough just to write some series like this. You need to include also non-perturbatively small terms, which Poincaré told us not to consider when doing asymptotic expansions. And possibly, you might also have to consider logarithms. Now again, I stress that mathematicians have restricted their definition of what is a resurgent function to make it nice and manageable. Physically, the question is that set of functions relevant for physics? And it's not obvious.
So in the definition of the trans series, you allow just integer powers of
I mean, there may be some fractional power out front, but the basic object is...
But you don't allow sums of the different
No, this is summing up the different instanton sectors.
But there might be other points with higher action.
Okay, so that's true.
Well, these have higher action
when k is large.
And multiple.
Yeah, there may be different classes that you have to sum up.
That's also included.
Sum two of these together, yeah. All right, let me show you how to decode what information is contained in here. Imagine we looked at the sector where k is zero and L is, therefore L doesn't exist. So it's just the sum of n. So this is perturbation theory. So these guys aren't here. This thing grows factorially fast. Okay. If it's also non-alternating, this generates an imaginary part which goes like I pi u minus 1 over g squared with some coefficient alpha, and that comes from a n 0 0 grows like n factorial times alpha. Okay. Now, you look in the sector where, where k equals 2, because k has to be at least 2 in order to have this sum here. In the sector where k equals 2, you can have a logarithm. Okay? And there's a minus here. This minus, of course, is e to the plus or minus I pi. So the logarithm generates an I. And you discover that if you were to look at a 0, 2, 1, it would be equal to minus alpha. Okay? So the coefficients in this trend series are not independent of one another. Maybe I mean 2 in factorial. That's why I was pausing for a second there. Okay, maybe it's a 2. Now, the more interesting thing happens at the next order. Suppose you look at the k equals 1 sector. When k equals 1, that's the single instanton, so that's this basic splitting. But now you can be more precise and ask, what's the fluctuations around that? Okay, so there's a series when k equals 1, L equals 0, therefore. There's still a series expansion. Okay? It's divergent. And you discover, to your surprise, my surprise, that it doesn't just diverge like this. So you've got it in the one instant sector, you've got this. Let's say 1 plus p1 g squared plus p2 g to the fourth plus. And the bn's grow like n factorial over 2 to the n, but there's an a log n plus p. So there is a new behavior. There's a logarithmic piece. Okay? And now this, by this Borel argument, since it's non-alternating, generates two different types of terms. This thing generates the ordinary exponential with an I in front. This thing generates that with a log g squared in front. Okay? But there was already an e to the minus 1 over g squared in front. This stuff generates an e to the minus 2 over g squared because of this. So now you look in the sector where k equals 3. When k equals 3, L can be 1 or 0, 1 or 2. So the one where it's 2, you have log minus 1 over g squared squared. So this is going to give you an I times a log g squared. Now you look at the coefficient, and it turns out to be exactly this coefficient. And then you look at the piece that was linear in log of minus 1 over g squared. That gives you an I pi. Coefficient of that term turns out to be b. Okay? So all of these expansion coefficients are not independent, and that's what makes this concept useful. Otherwise, I just made the problem 3 times harder by telling you you should make calculate a triple sum. But the fact is they're not independent of one another, and they're so tightly constrained that that's what leads to this dramatic statement that if you knew everything about the perturbative coefficients, In principle, you could, perhaps, reconstruct everything else. All right.
Wait, that's a statement that AM00 determines all the other.
No, no, no. Yes.
AM00.
So I will show you now an example where this works.
K equal 1, it was in dependent series, so it was dependent. So for 1 is.
At first sight, it's independent.
Yeah.
But what I'm going to tell you is that it's not independent.
And so far, you just said it was.
Yeah.
Determined that one instant and instant, two instant, one instant. Okay.
Right. Okay. But then I can continue this.
But I have back to A0.
Now I'm going to show you how that works. So this is the surprising, one of the surprising aspects. I was extremely skeptical about this. I didn't think it would work, even in quantum mechanics. So this paper with, I think these two papers with Mithat, we investigated two canonical examples in quantum mechanics, which are the double well problem and the periodic potential problem. So everybody knows that you get splitting at levels. It becomes exponentially small as this barrier gets big and these go far apart. Here, you get bands, which are also exponentially narrow as the wells separate and the barrier gets higher. Okay, so everybody knows this. And the usual estimate of the width of the splitting or those bands is what we call, what you guys call some overlap, exponentially small overlap, or instanton or tunneling effect. Different language, but it's the same thing. So now I'm going to show you how solving this problem generates a trend series. Okay? I think it should be relatively clear if I ignore the logs. Right? Clearly, you know, if you want to write down the energy of this level, there's a series, but you also know they're exponentially small pieces, and you could at least believe that there are subleading exponentially small pieces. So I think this much is natural, at least as the form. But this is less clear. And the relations between the coefficients is less clear. So now I want to be really concrete and just do one example. I'll do this example. So I'm going to write potential like this. And to me, h bar is 1, m is 1/2 or whatever, just to get rid of all the factors. But so the separation between these two wells goes like 1 over g. So when g is small, they go far apart. The height of this barrier goes like 1 over g squared. So as g goes to 0, I just have an isolated harmonic oscillator at the location of each minute, right? And we know how to solve that problem. Okay, so the clever trick is to rescale and define y to be gx. And then my Schrodinger equation just looks like this. Okay. All right. So now you see that g squared is looking like h bar, so it's not surprising to see non-perturbative things like e to the minus 1 over g squared. Okay. Now, how do you solve this problem? How do you really solve this problem? Exactly. So your options are limited. You could try and use WKB. Not a good idea. Usual WKB. A much more sophisticated idea is to use what's called uniform WKB. The reason is, when G is very small, you've basically got a harmonic oscillator here. Okay? So the clever thing to do is to write the wave function. And remember, we're trying to solve this problem by solving around 1 of the minimum. So the clever thing to do is not to use ordinary WKB, but to write psi in terms of the solution to the harmonic oscillator problem, which are the parabolic cylinder functions. What did I use here? U of y over square root of u prime of y. Okay, so you rewrite your solution as a solution to the harmonic oscillator problem. This is just the exponential times the Hermite polynomials. You have to divide by this square root of u prime. In the normal case, this is just y, and so this is just 1. But now I've done two things here. I've rewritten my function in terms of another function. I haven't done anything really yet. So my Schrodinger equation for psi turns into a complicated nonlinear equation for u. And it looks like I've just taken a spectacular leap backwards because I turned a linear problem into a nonlinear problem. But this turns out to be quite useful. I also introduced a parameter, nu, and we have to understand what it means. If nu is an integer, then it's just a harmonic oscillator. Okay? And now you just do perturbation theory as usual in terms of the energy and in terms of u. So you expand E as a sum n equals 0 to infinity, E n t to the 2n. But remember, it's going to depend on this parameter nu that I introduced because it shows up in the equation. And a similar expansion for the function u. And you just do perturbation theory. You just close your eyes and just calculate. Okay? But not in terms of psi, in terms of u. Now, if you do this, you discover, first of all, very easily, that these are just polynomials in nu. And if nu was an integer, this procedure just gives you perturbation theory for the energy. Okay? It's a relative. I think that's believable. For the wave functions, it's much more interesting. If nu is an integer, you get the perturbed wave function, but you get it in a resummed form. You get it as a parabolic cylinder function of some series. It's as if you took your perturbative expansion of psi and resummed it, so it's much more precise than doing ordinary perturbation theory. Okay. Now, the fact that if I put nu equals to an integer, I get ordinary perturbation theory tells you that this thing is non-Borel summable. And that's going to be the key point. It's non-Borel summable, but you shouldn't be surprised. Non-Borel summable means the answer is not defined, but you shouldn't be surprised that the answer is not defined because I didn't solve the real problem. I just solved the problem in this well. I didn't tell the system that there's another one yet. Okay? So I have to apply a boundary condition that tells the system that there's another well. Okay, now how do I do that? I've chosen for simplicity a symmetric potential, so I can use the fact that I know in advance that the exact wave functions are either odd or even functions about the midpoint. Okay, it's completely obvious, just a parity symmetry here. That tells me that my boundary condition that really solves the problem is that the wave functions really fall off here, as they did in my harmonic oscillator problem. But here, at this midpoint, I have to impose the condition that either the function is zero or its derivative is zero. That makes it odd or even at the midpoint, right? About the midpoint. What? And one of them will be the upper level and one of them will be the lower level. Okay? So let's consider the upper level, which is actually the odd guy. And that's that the function must be zero at this midpoint. Okay? So how does that look? My condition then is that d nu of 1 over g, u evaluated at the midpoint, must be zero.
What about d minus nu? Because it's speaking of two solutions, right?
Yeah, don't worry about it. That's how you build the odd and even one. It's all taken care of in the next line, okay? So this is the exact formula for the solution, okay? Remember, this guy is a series in G and nu, okay? With coefficients that depend on nu. So this is a crazy formula that tells me nu in terms of G in some weird transcendental way. I then take that and I plug it into here, and I have my answer. So let's try and understand how to solve that equation in some expansion sense. And so the usual thing you do is you want this parabolic solenoid function to be normalizable, and that's what tells you that nu must be an integer. And this, you use what Arkady just said, is that one of these solutions goes like e to the minus z squared over 4 at plus infinity, and the other one goes like e to the plus z squared over 4. That guy's not normalizable, so you kill that guy and you're just left with a normalizable. However, this is where Borel summation enters. This thing here, as a function of g, is non-Borel summable. Therefore, to make sense of that series, that formal series, I need to analytically continue g squared off the positive real axis, just by a little bit. Remember those contours going just above or just below? Okay. As soon as I do that, this number here is now complex. Okay, a little bit, but it's complex. And now, remember, g is going to 0, and the leading magnitude of this is of order 1, so the argument is becoming large, but complex. Okay? So now I have to look up a math tables or something and look at the asymptotic behavior of this function, but not just along the real axis, just off the real axis. And you can look up that d nu of z goes like z to the nu. Right, so that's the term we know and love. It's the Gaussian piece and the how you construct the Hermite polynomial. And there's some fluctuations involving powers of 1 over z squared. But then there's another term, where the plus or minus depends on whether we went above or below the axis. And normally we kill this term because it's growing, and we kill it by taking nu to be an integer. Okay? It's the harmonic oscillator problem. But now in this problem, I'm off the real axis, and I want to impose this condition. So the way this condition works is I have to balance this term against this term to be zero. And now you see what's going to happen. You're going to get an equation that looks something like this. 1 over gamma minus nu, e to the plus or minus pi over g squared minus nu is equal to e to the minus okay, so there's some exponential thing, which I'm going to write as e to the minus z squared over 4, where z is this. Okay, so the leading term will give me some number over g squared, and then expanding all the rest of the junk will contribute to fluctuations. There's powers of 1 over z, which give me some 1 over g squared type stuff, and there's this gamma.
Is that the gamma condition for your function to be always real?
No, that's the condition for it
to vanish at the midpoint. The wave function is real.
That's the condition for it to vanish at the midpoint.
Okay.
Okay. When I analytically continue back to g squared on the real axis, it will be real. Now, just look at this equation for a second. If g squared is 0, this is 0. And nu must be an integer. If g squared is not quite 0, then this is small. It's exponentially small. So nu should be close to an integer. So what you do is you just look at this equation and you write nu as an integer plus a small bit, and then you just expand. And you discover that nu is equal to an integer plus leading term looks like this. I've separated out what I'm going to call the single instanton factor. There's some factorial business depending which level I'm talking about, and there are fluctuations around this. Now the interesting thing happens at the next order. I get the same thing squared. Well, actually, this, just this part of it squared, multiplied by f squared, so f df n plus f squared times log of e to the plus or minus I to pi of the g squared. So at the two instanton level, I see a log. And I stress that this log, it came simply from expanding this guy and this guy. Okay. Is that at least believable?
Yeah, of course, because you just squared to the power u, and then you get the log.
Yep. Okay. Now I take this expression. These are polynomials. I insert them in here. And now you see the answer for the energy is a series in g squared, and a series in exponentials, and a series in logs. It's a trend series. Okay? Moreover, it came just from the analytic continuation properties of the parabolic cylinder function. Therefore, all these miraculous cancellations are built in. Okay? They're just there. If you really want to do the work of expanding and looking at one sector, you'll get nonsense. But if you look at the whole thing, including both the perturbative and non-perturbative sectors, it's well-defined, it's real, it's unambiguous. Okay? So that's it. It's not that complicated, actually. All right. Now.
So just for intuitive understanding, why is uniform semi-classics the optimal way to get started?
Because what would be the alternative? The alternative would be to have two turning points here and do this stuff. But normal WKB is divergent at turning points. So you have to do all this ridiculous matching nonsense. Whereas uniform WKB is completely well-defined at the turning point.
So it's correct at the top of your barrier, right? That's what
you're
saying.
It also goes through it. No, it's more than that. It's correct at these turning points.
No, the barrier there. Right?
Also, a more important statement is that it's well defined at the turning points, which ordinary WKB is not.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay? So it's much, much easier. Okay. Now, that's not the interesting point. The interesting point here is that everything comes from just two functions. I need to know this function. Okay? And that's perturbation theory, depending on the level. So for each level, I do perturbation theory. Okay? But I need to know one more function. I need to know this function, which is the, when in the end I see it, I understand that it's the fluctuations around the single entropy point. But that's enough. Everything else in the entire trans series comes from those two functions, okay? Because I'm just expanding this formula. Okay? Now, this is a proof, if you like, using uniform WKB, of a beautiful observation by Zengerstein and Ulrich Genschurer from the big 2004. They conjectured this fact with a lot of very beautiful analysis, including numerical analysis, that in fact these two functions were enough to generate the entire trans series. Extremely beautiful work. So you need three things. You need to know this, which I call perturbation theory. You need to know perturbation theory around the single instanton. And you need to know the rule. And the rule is, you have to look at the wave, the potential. The rule is parity here. Here it's block symmetry. You say that when you go through a phase, you go through a period, you change by a block phase. Okay, so that will give you a slightly modified form of this condition. But otherwise, if the potentials are harmonic in these each of the wells, the answer is the same.
In terms
of
the
same form.
Yeah, but okay.
If they have different frequency, you have to work a little bit harder, but it's the same idea.
In this way, it's still two series, one for E and one for this one.
Okay, right. So far. Now, let me tell you what Mithat and I discovered, something even more surprising. In fact, whoops. Right, so this is perturbation theory. And let me write F. So there are going to be some factors wrong here, but you can find the right factors in the paper. But let's just, as a matter of convention, let's just redefine this as in terms of a function A. Then there's an amazing result, is that dE, dN is essentially there are four problems for which we know this is true, and the technical restriction is you have to know something about the Riemann surface of the periods for this problem. So,
what is N?
N is nu. So,
new.
When I do perturbation theory, this
Number of levels.
Yeah, label of the level. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what this means is, if I know this function, I can in one line write down the other function. They know its normalization also. So, okay? So this is the sense in which this vision of a curl, that knowing the fluctuations around some point, you can reconstruct the topology of all the other saddle points. And in fact, if you know how to decode it, which is not obvious in the beginning, but if you know how to decode the information, all of the information for the entire trans series is encoded in one function, which is perturbation theory. Okay? So this is,
This is a, this functional relation holds for general or for these four examples?
So I can't give you at the moment an absolutely precise statement that you would understand, because it requires some structure for the, a little more carefully. So what's going on here? With WKB, just the way you would roughly do this with WKB, you do this and you apply a Bohr-Sommerfeld condition, and that will give you some approximation for the location of the level. In order to get the splitting, you need this guy. Okay? Now the point is that these two are very deeply related. In classical mechanics language, it's a Legendre transform between these two action integrals. And the surprising thing is that that still works at the quantum level. But if I have a potential with barriers that are different than whatever, I'll need more functions, but it will be a finite number of functions that I need.
Now, for levels. Now, for levels at the top of your barriers, the turning points, as you showed the other day, the complex plane, what do you do then?
Can I talk about that later?
Okay.
This is very interesting. Okay, I really want to get to the next one. So I don't know about you, but I think this is kind of surprising. And it deserves a deeper answer, because I just did WKB on a differential equation. But if I want to look for something like this in field theory, it's a waste of time talking about differential equations. I should try and understand this in terms of path integrals. So let me tell you something about steepest descents that you may not know. So this is this comes from work of Michael Berry, and Chris Howells, called Hyperasymptotics. From about 1990. So now let me step back and not do a path integral, but just do an ordinary integral. Imagine you had a contour integral. So what is this? Pictorially, this is, I've got some contour going through one of the critical points of this function. Okay. Now when g squared is small, we all know what to do. It's just e to the minus f at that critical point divided by g squared. And there's some fluctuation stuff from the Gaussian integral with the fluctuations around there. And then we stop. Okay, but suppose you don't stop. Suppose you look at the fluctuations. I've forgotten what. Okay, I have to use a different index here. Okay, so the notation is, this is the behavior around this saddle point. The leading behavior is what you all know and expect. But let's consider the fluctuations. The fluctuations will be a series in g squared, but this is for the nth saddle point, and r labels the order of that expansion. Okay, so normally we don't worry about this. Well, it turns out, imagine the situation where you have several different saddle points and corresponding steepest descent contours going through them. It turns out that with some relatively mild conditions on the function f, you can do some contour juggling of these expressions and learn that there's an amazing formula relating the fluctuations, just this bit here, around n is related to the fluctuations around all the other guys.
Hold on,
okay.
Here there's no function of g squared in your notation,
right? This is expanded like this. Expanded. Okay. Okay, so this is far and away the most surprising formula you're going to see today. It says that the fluctuations around saddle point n can be written as an integral of the fluctuations around all the other saddle points, where all the other means actually summed over the ones that can be connected by a steepest descent contour. So there's some very interesting topology here about which curves connect to which. That's all buried in the sum. The point is that I can now use this, and I can expand the right-hand side in g squared, and I learn that the coefficients. So this is the function. Now I look at the coefficients. Grow like a factorial. And this is just some sign depending on the orientation of the contours. So the leading behavior is this capital F, which is the difference between the function at the two points. So this factorial divided by the action to the end, that's what we saw before. The interesting thing is that the coefficient is the zeroth coefficient around this point. And the subleading guy is fnm over r minus 1 times the first coefficient around the other point. And then it continues. R minus 1, R minus 2, T and 2. Okay? So if I look at the fluctuations around here, fluctuations around here, the coefficients are all related to one another. And not just sort of related, they're related. They're the same numbers. Okay? And so if you can understand this topology of all these saddle points, you can actually reconstruct everything from one of the saddle points.
Now, what happens when the two saddle points coalesce?
Then it's a little bit more complicated, but not too much more complicated. Okay. I don't have time to get into that, sorry. Okay, so I was going to give you an example, but running out of time. So this is for ordinary functions. You could ask, okay, let me try and do this in two dimensions. You fall flat immediately. So let's be physicists. Forget about two dimensions. Let's just go to infinity directly. And let's do this for path integrals. Okay? So let me write down the path integral for, say, the periodic potential problem, and you discover that the fluctuations around the vacuum saddle point, so you write the path integral, the simplest thing is to do perturbation theory, which is fluctuations around the vacuum. The coefficients, An, grow like N factorial, 1 minus 5 halves, 1 over N, minus 13 eighths, 1 over N, N minus 1, minus 13. So this was just the thing I told you before, that they grow factorially, but with a little bit more work, you can get the subleading times. And now you look at the fluctuations around the instanton, anti-instanton sector. That's the nearest one that has the same quantum numbers as the vacuum. And some heroic people calculated the imaginary part of the energy for the fluctuations around this point, and they discovered it's e to the minus 2 times 1 over 2 g squared, so 1 over g squared, but I put the 2 there because it's a 2 instanton effect. And the fluctuations are, I think that's a 2. Okay. So the coefficients of the fluctuations around the nearest connected saddle point are exactly the same numbers as you get from the subleading behavior around vacuum. Okay? It's exactly the same structure as this, and presumably this is the deep reason why this is happening. Now, it's worth keeping in mind something you already know from basic calculus called Dubus theorem, that if you look at high orders of derivatives around some point, the convergence or divergence of that expansion is governed by the nearest critical point. And in this language, the nearest singular point or critical point is the next saddle point that it's connected to. This is as if there was a functional version of that, okay, which is extremely surprising because we know essentially nothing about the real analytic structure of path integrals. All right, now, if I'm permitted to have a few more minutes, just say why this is potentially interesting. So analytic continuation of path integrals. So there's an idea floating around in various branches of theoretical physics to try and study analytic continuation of path integrals. I think I don't need to motivate it very much. But the idea is the following. Suppose you've got some integral like this, and I just explained that there's this interesting structure about the saddle point. Suppose I just bravely think that this might work for the path integral. Or in the summing over paths, not over just integrating over a coordinate. Okay? Now the idea is the following. The way you treat these problems is you go to steepest descent contours. Okay? Now the, and I might as well actually be, might as well put an I here. Just do the real thing. So what is a steepest descent contour? It's a contour along which the imaginary part of that function is constant. It's the definition of the steepest descent contour. So suppose you could define somehow the analog of a steepest descent contour for the functional integral. Suppose. This has a name, it's called a thimble, because if you think of a multidimensional thing like that, rotated, it looks a little bit like a thimble. And this is being explored a lot in field theory at the moment. Imagine you could do that. So you deform your path integral like this. Real part of S. I can pull out the imaginary part because it's constant on that contour. And now all my problems, not all, but most of my problems with dealing with an oscillatory phase here in a path integral have disappeared. Because I now have a real positive action with a minus sign here that I can now hopefully do either Monte Carlo, numerically, or I can do some sort of semi-classical analysis along the lines I just said, and that these differences, now I also know that the different saddle points that I generate here will be related to one another in some direct quantitative way. So if this could be made to work, it would be a dramatic improvement in many branches, not just of physics, but chemistry, biology, places, mathematics.
Could be used to solve the same problems.
So there are people, it's not a joke. There are lattice gauge theory people right now developing algorithms to solve the sign problem by doing exactly this. The sign problem is if we try to do finite density interacting fermion systems, this thing, the Euclidean path integral, has an action that has an imaginary part. So your usual Monte Carlo algorithms simply don't work. Okay? All right. Now, you should be skeptical. But let me finish just with one example where we see that this actually works. So I talked about the periodic potential, which was, roughly speaking, sine squared of x. Okay. Let's generalize this to some elliptic function that depends on some parameter. So this thing looks like this. This thing, when m is small, it looks the same. But when m approaches 1, it looks like this. Okay? And it's just completely smooth as a function of m. So now, we repeated this analysis, not for this guy, but for this guy. We studied large orders of perturbation theory. And the prediction is that an should go like n factorial divided by twice the instanton action to the power n, where the instanton is just the guy tunneling from there to there. Okay? So that's what I've been telling you all along. So we tested it. We calculated the instanton action. We computed the first 30 terms in perturbation theory. And you can see quite clearly that this is simply not true. Okay? Now, we actually constructed it because we knew it was not going to be true. So the answer is that this function is periodic, obviously. This function is periodic, obviously. But actually, this elliptic function is doubly periodic. It's also periodic in the complex direction. Okay? And now you say, well, who cares? Because I'm doing a path integral over real paths. So I don't care about the complex direction. But if you evaluate the tunneling in the complex direction and you add its contribution to some other action for that, now it matches perfectly perturbation theory. So this is an explicit example where you start with a path integral and it looks like all your paths are real. But if you try to do this semi-classical analysis, you discover that you must also consider analytically continued paths. Right? So it's a contribution from one contour plus a contribution from another contour.
And S prime is smaller than this?
Sorry?
S prime is smaller than this?
They're both functions of m, so it actually depends whether m is less than a half or bigger than a half.
A half is the
prime. Yeah, and when it's a half, the odd ones cancel or something. Odd or even ones cancel. Okay, so I've gone way over my time. I apologize. Let me just summarize. So, so resurgence is not yet in my opinion, not yet a working, self-contained, fully understood mechanism, but it's a very interesting framework in which to view certain problems, particularly strongly interacting problems or strong field problems. And the basic message is that perturbation theory and non-perturbative physics are related to one another in a much deeper level than you might have thought just from the, you know, splitting of two levels argument, which is the usual textbook approach. There's much more structure, both in perturbation theory and in non-perturbative physics. And if you can learn how to understand that in non-trivial problems, then you can make some progress. Now, why is this interesting in quantum field theory? It's interesting in quantum field theory because important quantum field theory problems, such as Yang-Mills theory, analogs of that called sigma models, have exactly this thickness in perturbation theory, that they're non-Borel summable. And these guys have also this structure of non-perturbative effects that are that can be unstable in terms of their attraction. Even more interesting, there are field theories where perturbation theory has this thickness, but there are no Winstontons. For the experts, ON model, n bigger than 3, principal chiral model. Nevertheless, there are exact saddle points whose fluctuations give you imaginary parts. So that's where things stand at the moment. So I thank you for your patience.
In this case, in the second case, in the case where you have a complex and a non-Borel summable Winstonton and a complex saddle point, which is Borel summable, what happened in this case? What determined? Is it still perturbation theory that determines everything? Or is it more complicated?
We actually don't know the answer precisely. But so I think the answer is yes, but we haven't done all the details. So what you need to know, again, you need to know this guy and this guy, clearly. And then the question is, are these two related to one another? And the relation is, in fact, similar to this, except I have to replace, when I do this interchange, I have to replace m by 1 minus m. So if I know to do that, then yes.
But what about action and imaginary direction? It's different.
That's just given by this one, m goes to 1 minus m.
I see. So in this way, it's related to
that. But you have to know that. So it's something special about this elliptic form.
But you're always working around a minimum. In molecular physics, very often we're interested in states just around near the top of the barrier. And as you know, the turning points are complex, not real. You're dealing with real turning points here, right? In your problem. What do you do then?
This is a subject of another talk, but it is known how to do it. If you take, let's look at this problem. It's a little bit more interesting than this one.
Yeah.
So remember, G is small, so the barrier is very high, and these are far apart. So if I, what I've told you so far corresponds to this region, right? So I'm deep inside the well. There are these exponentially small splittings of the bands, and I can expand in this exponentially small thing and get more and more precision. Okay. Now let's think, what happens up here? Then I'll talk about the barrier.
Just at the top, zero energy, right?
Yes, wait. What happens up there? What happens up there is that it's almost a continuum.
Right.
But there are very small gaps. So I can describe exactly that problem, but I interchange basically this guy with this guy to describe the width of the gaps. Because now they're complex turning points, but the integral between these complex turning points gives me the width of that gap. If you take either of those formulas that you find in Landau-Lipschitz, that this splitting is 2 h bar omega over pi e to the minus the instanton, this factor, this is the inverse period of this thing that's either going through or above. This factor diverges as you approach the top of the barrier.
That's right.
This has been known for many, many years. So what you need to do is just be a little bit more careful. And you do uniform WKB with G complex.
Right.
With G complex, you actually go around this divergence. So it's possible to do it so that you smoothly go from here to here. But the behavior near the barrier is completely different. For example, if you think of tunneling just above the barrier, at the barrier top, if it's harmonic, the probability is exactly 1/2 of transmission or reflection. Okay? So you have to build that in. And the way it turns up here is that here, this gap and this band have equal width, and they're not exponential. And the reason is, and I think I erased it, but there was a factor of g squared to the n over n factorial, but at this point, n is of the order of 1 over g squared, and you get another exponential from this. So it's...
Okay, so and then last year, then we have your an, you have two terms, if I understand correct. So the first term coming from the rho of your action.
From the what?
From the integral of your rho part of
yeah.
your s.
Yeah.
And the second term from your the imaginary part. And the reason you want the both part is you want to, because, okay, the results from the perturbation theory should have both parts.
So the logic was the following.
Yeah.
This is the standard argument. Okay? We tested it. It did not work.
You mean that it doesn't satisfy the basic
just
result?
Check that they don't agree.
Okay.
So the reason they don't agree, if you believe that it's reasonable to make an expansion of a path integral, which is a big if, mm-hmm. if you believe that you can do that, then there is another saddle point. It's complex. Normally you would say, I don't care about that saddle point. But our statement is, if you take into account the contribution from that saddle point, that's this term. And now you go and check with perturbation theory, and it agrees. Okay, so I would, this is not a derivation of anything. This is a evidence that, in fact, expanding a path integral about all the saddle points is the right thing to do.
And then there's there any like mathematical logic or rules to decide if or if not?
There's no mathematical logic at all about path integrals, right? They're extremely poorly defined. That's the whole point here. We're exploring to what degree it's reasonable to do analytic continuation of path integrals.
And then because we know the results from the division
theory
is correct,
can test.
So
can
you
test.
Use that as your test.
Yeah.
You do not say that the other result is wrong.
So it passed the first test.
Okay.
There are more subtle tests to lower order, to higher order, but.
Okay, let's thank you again.